Okay, it's 12:30, so we're going to start. I'd like to welcome you all to this Pedal September speaker series, the second session in our of our three speaker sessions. My name's Paul Ramchandani. I'm the LEGO Professor of Play here at University of Cambridge, and I direct the Pedal Research Centre, which I'll tell you a little bit about in a moment. I'm going to be chairing this session on potential in play, thinking about the potential of play in tackling inequalities and play's potential during this pandemic. We've got two fantastic speakers who you can hopefully see in to one side or on top of your screen. Amy Jo Dowd from the LEGO Foundation and Krishna Kulkarni from the Pedal Research Centre. Before I introduce them properly, I want to just do a few housekeeping notes and a very brief introduction to the Pedal Centre. So we're going to be using Zoom conference, which is a bit different to your usual Zoom. As a participant, you'll be muted and your camera is off, so we can't see you, we can't hear you. If you do have a question that you'd like to ask one or both of our speakers, please use the Q&A function, which is in the strand either at the bottom or top of your screen, depending on how you're set up. If you send a question into that Q&A function, it will appear, and at the end of this session, when both speakers have spoken, I will try and pick some of those questions up to ask Amy, Joe, and Krishna. We may not be able to get through all of them, but we'll try and get through a few of them for both speakers. We'll be recording the session so that you can still see this webinar later, even if you have to leave for any reason at some point during proceedings. And at the end, I'll say goodbye, and the meeting will end suddenly, quite abruptly. So it's a bit different to usual conferences where there'll be no applause, there'll be no chance to queue up for a quick chat. If you want to recreate the experience for yourself, you can go off and make yourself a cold cup of coffee and eat a plate full of pastries after the speakers have finished. But it will feel a bit different to your normal conference experience. So I'm going to briefly share some slides with you. So this is the session today, The Way We Play, Potential in Play, with Amy Jo Dowd and Krishna Kulkarni as our speakers. I'm going to give you a brief introduction to the Pedal Centre. The Pedal Centre is a research centre looking at play in education, development and learning. It was set up at the University of Cambridge in the Faculty of Education, and the substantial initial funding came from the LEGO Foundation. We have three core aims. First, to undertake and provide world-class research on play. Second, to build capacity in play research. And third, to seek to influence policy and practice in regard to childhood and where play fits within childhood. You can read more about the work that we do on the web link, on the link there, pedalhub.org.uk. So please do feel free to go and have a look. The key to all of our three aims and meeting all our three aims really is collaboration. That's collaboration with researchers, with practitioners, with policymakers, and collaboration runs through the work that we do. So you're in the second of a series of three lunchtime webinars. This second one is looking at the potential of play. Next week, we have another one at the same time next Thursday on play in the pandemic, looking at play in the pandemic in schools and early childcare settings. So if you haven't signed up for that already and you're interested, please do. And you can find out more about the Pedal Centre. There's our email, our website, and Twitter and Instagram. And I'm not very good at using QR codes, but if you are, you can use that to sign up to our mailing list. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our speakers, Amy Jo Dowd and Krishna Kulkarni. Amy Jo is going to speak first. Amy Jo is the head of evidence at the LEGO Foundation, and prior to that, she was the senior director of education research at Save the Children in the US. And she's going to be sharing the results of a research report on playful learning. She'll be speaking for about 15 minutes and then be followed immediately by Krishna Kulkarni, who is a doctoral student here at Pedal. She's going to be telling us about her study of parent-child play in India, and about how that was at least partly interrupted or at least diverted by the COVID pandemic, and how she has adapted to that situation to learn more about parent-child play in that setting. So I'm looking forward to hearing both of them. But first of all, I'm going to hand over immediately to Amy Jo. Thank you, Amy Jo.
Awesome. So thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm thrilled to present today on play in the pursuit of impact and equality. This is a new paper. This is its first airing, so my sub-agenda is that you all ask tremendously hard questions and I'm able to make some revisions and improvements before we go to press. I'm going to frame this by talking a little bit about play, learning, and equality, and how thinking about these led us to our main research question, which is to understand what do we know about play and its presence in impactful efforts already. Then we're going to talk a little bit about the methods that we use, the sites and the interventions that we reviewed, before I turn to the findings and really look at those through the three lenses that the LEGO Foundation usually uses to think about play, which is facilitation, characteristics, and types. And then I hope that through sharing the conclusions and next steps, you'll have ideas about sort of all of the work that we have together to do in pushing this agenda forward. So let's dive in to play, learning, and inequality. To frame this, I actually want to start with inequality, because there's, in early childhood studies, lots of studies of distributional mechanisms for tackling inequality, whether it's reducing poverty by tackling, by targeting the most disadvantaged, redistributing taxes via early childhood investment, or maybe investing in lower and middle class groups all at once. These are very common in early childhood research, and so there's lots of fodder of this for the study. Less common, but not less important, are studies of relational mechanisms that really consider the structure and the quality of relations that transact either to produce, reproduce, or transform inequality. So the nature of our question led us to focus more on the distributional mechanism studies, but I really think on our to-do list and our sort of wish list is more studies on the relational side. For taking up play, I think there's more and more evidence about the benefits of play for learning and resilience for learning. And yet I think that play remains often as pitted as sort of versus learning. And it's singularly absent in the global dialogues about the learning crisis. Now, this is in part because the dialogue focuses on schools where learning is much more serious and not fun business. But it is made worse by the fact that we remain challenged by a lack of established good measurement of both play and the holistic skills that it benefits. So we're lacking evidence to strengthen our understanding and our advocacy. So for this reason, the study really set out to look back over the last decade of impact studies in early childhood to understand what we might already know about play, learning, and equality so that we can chart a course forward based on the evidence. So we looked across peer review literature and databases, institutional websites, with really four filters in mind. The first is play, all about being play-based, actively engaging, iterative, all these kinds of words were our search terms that we were looking for. The second was early childhood. We really focused in on ages 3 to 6 using these kinds of terms. And then finally, looking at impact studies, the types of designs was a final, was an additional screening tool that we used. And by the time we got here, because of the distributional studies dominance really in this field, almost everything had some element of addressing inequality or disadvantage. This process led us to 26 studies in 18 countries across the world. Several sites actually turned out to have multiple studies. This is because they went to scale, they tested perhaps alternative hypotheses, or maybe they followed children over time or several of these. So this is really a broader geographic scope than prior studies of play. It's also the case that we were able to have studies that included dozens, instead of just dozens or hundreds of children, it was dozens or hundreds of sites. So much larger scale than prior studies or reviews. What we found, however, was that the interventions were described in just a couple of paragraphs, and we wanted to know more. So in addition to the review of the documents, we contacted all of the authors, and we did a key informant interview with all of with the colleagues familiar with the classrooms in each of the studies. So what we learned about the interventions was that teacher training was always present, but it varied a great deal in duration and in location, from multiple one-day local training workshops to weeks-long residential trainings. In terms of teacher support, follow-up teacher support was also so common, particularly teacher training was short and intensive, but it too varied in form from in-class coaching and on-site experts to monthly follow-up training and consultations. All of the interventions have manipulatives of these kinds, and all of them laid claim to including these kinds of activities, singing, reading, playing, storytelling. However, a few of the interventions included parent engagement, whether it was via workshops or more deliberate and direct parent training, and only one had follow-up support to the parent workshop facilitators. I think it's important to note that some of these interventions were moving just slightly away from instructor-led, teacher-led early childhood, and others were moving more aggressively towards child choice and learning through play. And this was something that we came to think about as sort of some incremental movement towards play and sort of more disruptive movement toward play that we saw across these. Across the studies, there was also a broad wide variety of domains measured in terms of learning outcomes. These were most often language and literacy, cognitive, math, and social emotional. Some also had physical and veered into the physiological, and one with creativity. Among those that spanned across time, there was evidence of fade out, but more often for the academic skills. And where the play was stronger, and we'll get to what that means later, there's a twinkle of evidence for sustained learning, advantages in academics and non-academic topics, but the evidence is quite slim. There's a lot of work to do on that as well. Moving into the findings, one thing that was quite interesting that even as all of these were implemented in spaces where they are serving disadvantaged children and showing impact for those groups, seven of them also closed gaps within those groups. So they closed the gap between more and less socioeconomically advantaged children. And interestingly, these were also described by the authors as including more free and guided play. So I'm going to move now to consideration of the facilitation practices. There's free play, there's some guided play. Facilitation for the LEGO Foundation in terms of play really exists on a spectrum from the structured and teacher-led approaches on the one end through guided play over to free play, where as you go, children have more initiative, more choice, and teachers' influence becomes more and more light touch. Now, many examples in this study are from the more teacher-directed end of the spectrum. And one author described it this way: for an activity about water play and measurement, the teacher sets out a bucket, water, and small and larger measures, then tells the children what to do, rather than let the children have these materials and play with them, and ask questions about the play and probe. It's a small difference, but it gives up the child initiative. The same happens with ABC items. Pair up children and give them a task. It is still teacher-directed. But nine of these interventions, including several from very resource-constrained contexts, were described as having teachers guiding play in the classrooms. As they showed both learning impact and were more likely to be among those that closed the achievement gaps, this suggests two things. First, the link between learning and play in more diverse settings than we previously knew about. And second, that the potential for a benefit that addresses inequality of outcomes might be there. So a more nuanced understanding of the differences between free play and guided play, games, and strategies that build the competencies of teachers for them would move this topic forward. The interventions that included free and guided play were also more likely to have the five characteristics of play that LEGO uses. And we'll turn to those now. These are being joyful or supporting child's curiosity and enjoyment in exploring and learning new things, being actively engaging and supporting their own interests and being absorbed in their activities, iterative as they test and try out new things, meaningful that builds on their own experiences and ideas in the local context, and socially interactive in supporting children and peers in groups activities to share and collaborate with each other. In terms of the five characteristics of learning through play, these These interventions were described by the author as most often as being meaningful, socially interactive, and actively engaging. The authors shared that it could be more difficult to see joyful in these classrooms, and even fewer noted having observed iteration. Where iteration and joy were seen were also spaces in which there was free and guided play, and this is also where we saw the closing of the gaps. But we need to do more to test whether this presence of children's choice, their engagement and exploration actually lead to better and more equal learning. And then finally, in terms of play types, the types of play that were most common were object play and games, quite clearly from this graphic. Pretend and symbolic play were used less often, and physical play even more so occasionally. And here, occasionally means that the interviewees described this as being present only as a break or as a time filler, but not being central to the intervention being evaluated. And to be honest, this question was a hard one for several respondents because they saw these types of play often as being overlapping. One described it this way: the complexity of play is such that you have pretend play superimposed over the others. When you have play in a park, the main activity is jumping around with a ball, but there are roles and parts in a battle. It isn't just physical play. Good players make pretend play out of other types. Pretend play is thinking play. Now, this isn't to say that pretend play is the ultimate, or that we can even tell this from this study. Some interventions only tested one type of play, such as games for promoting one skill, like math, as was the case in India, or two types of play, like games and object play, to build domain-crossing skills, such as friendship in Jamaica. So we conclude for now that the different types of play can promote learning in different ways, but we do need to know more about the ideal balance between these play facilitation and type options. So for now, we take away three big ideas. The first is that guiding children's play and allowing them choices in the classroom may present unique benefits to children's learning and to addressing inequality. Second, that using child-centered playful strategies takes more time and training than several of these trials invested, but it's possible even in very resource-constrained environments. Third, that we need a more nuanced understanding of both how to support teachers to use learning through play and how to measure its presence in ECD settings and its impact on child development. So what's next? We want to expand free and guided play's use, test its impact on learning and equality, and learn how to better support it, especially, as I said, in resource-constrained contexts. We want to test, and with better measures, both incremental and disruptive ways to increase play in ECD. We want to think about longitudinal studies and the breadth of skills with a focus on the fade-out. And then finally, pursue the play for impact and equality in early primary intervention studies to see if this frame can help us think about the learning crisis going on there as well. I will stop now and let Krishna take over, and I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you very much, Amy Jo. That's fascinating and wonderful to see research that's encompassing a global perspective from many, many different countries. Please do send your questions in. We've got a couple of questions coming in on the Q&A, but we can take them as we're going along, and then I'll ask them at the end. But if you type them in now, then they'll be there ready for me, and I'll be able to process them before asking them. But for now, we're moving on to Krishna Kulkarni, who I've done the introduction for, but she's going to be telling us about her research in India. And she's actually joining us from India. So we've got our speakers, Amy Jo's in Denmark. I'm sat here in Cambridge, and Krishna's in Pune in India. So it still blows my mind a little bit that we can have these kind of video conferences with people joining from all over the place and presenting from all over the place. But without further ado, I can hand over to Krishna. Thank you, Krishna.
Thanks very much, Paul. And thank you, Amy Jo, for that really, really interesting presentation. My name is Krishna. I'm a almost third year PhD student at PEDL. I split my life and my research interests between the UK and India, and through this presentation, I will share with you parts of my PhD research with a focus on play during the lockdown in India. My research focuses on parent-child play, It began with a focus on parent-child play in the UK using longitudinal data from the Healthy Start, Happy Start study conducted at Imperial College. I wanted to explore the association between parent play and children's outcomes. Having spent my life between the UK and India, I was naturally interested in the cultural differences in play and parent-child interactions. It has been widely accepted that while play and its benefits are universal, there is no one-size-fits-all approach that we can generalize, especially across cultures. There is also knowledge about how play can be affected by culture. As I made my way through existing literature on play, I found that very little of it could be applied to an Indian context. The knowledge generated from Western societies does not allow for generalization to non-Western populations, which have very different cultural beliefs and socioeconomic trends, all of which influence parenting and child outcomes. For example, research shows that it's likely that all communities vary to some degree about what they value for children's development. This is likely to affect what they consider to be play and what opportunities they provide for children to play. A categorization by Gaskins and colleagues identified types of play across cultures. Culturally curtailed play refers to play that's considered to have very little value and is sometimes discouraged. Culturally accepted play refers to play as a means of keeping children occupied while the parents work. However, adults neither actively participate nor discourage this kind of play. Culturally cultivated play is where adults not only encourage play, but do their best to facilitate play by providing the necessary resources as they consider play vital to children's development and learning. These vastly different approaches towards play are likely to also have varied impacts on parents' play engagement and children's development. There's minimal research about play in India, but I've had first-hand experience with how deeply entrenched play is in the Indian culture, which is what led me to studying play in India. I wanted to try and understand the perception of play for children and families in India, as well as what parents' attitudes towards play was. This is particularly important given that India has the largest population of people under 25. I included parents of 2 to 5-year-olds in my study in India, a similar age to the participants of the UK study. I decided to begin with urban families belonging to mid to high socioeconomic demographics around where my family in India lives. After beginning with a small sample of 6 families that I could easily access, I planned to move on to families in lower socioeconomic groups. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to do that, but more on that later. I conducted in-person interviews with the parents, mostly mothers, to develop a basic understanding of their play. I wanted to put parents at the front of research and have them drive it. Since it's a developing area, I chose semi-structured interviews. I wanted to explore the field from the ground up, rather than imposing existing ideas, especially those influenced by the West. Broadly, parents were asked about general information, such as routines and family structure, their ideas about play, how they played with their child, and how their child played generally. However, I was very aware of the limitations of conducting only interviews, especially if I wanted to make headway in a minimally researched area. There was a high risk for discrepancy between the parents' ideas of play and mine, or of parents being conscious of my presence. Importantly, having grown up in India but lived in the UK for several years, I was an Indigenous outsider. I had to make sure that the responses were represented authentically without being influenced by my perception and interpretation of the parents' responses. I therefore also conducted free play observations and a reflection session. For the play observation, I gave the parents a standard set of toys and asked them to play with their child as they normally would for about 5 minutes. Through this, I hope to find examples of play that parents might have mentioned during the interview, or, as importantly, something they had not mentioned. I hope that the interview and the play session would be mutually clarifying. I recorded the play session and then played it back to the parents when they were done. At this time, I asked them to reflect on their play and share any thoughts they had. I also asked them questions specific to their play or their responses in the interview. The point of the reflection was to allow parents to sit back and observe their interaction with their child. It allowed me to seek clarifications and for parents to share their thoughts and explanations. Parents shared their thoughts as they were watching the video, like a live commentary. These sessions were conducted immediately after the play session, so the experience was fresh. Parents were asked follow-up questions and clarifications after the video had been watched. The main purpose of this part was to give parents a chance to reflect on their play and perhaps understand the way why they played in a certain way, and also to avoid misinterpreting parents' behaviours. Parents were able to express themselves more clearly with the help of the video during reflection. For example, this parent here watched how she played with blocks with her child and shared her conflict between her role as an observer versus as a guide. The parents really enjoyed the whole process, especially watching the play session. Though the data are yet to be analysed fully, there were some interesting points worth noting. First was the involvement of grandparents. All families reported a high involvement of grandparents in activities ranging from play to feeding, and in some cases, grandparents were the primary caregivers. Next, during the play session, parents largely followed their child's lead while playing, allowing the children to choose the object and pace of play. They tended to be quite instructional in their play, quizzing children on the names of colours or recent experiences or spellings while playing. Unfortunately, progress on this round was paused to make way for more relevant and time-critical research. I returned to Cambridge to transcribe, analyse and switch gears to my UK study. However, COVID had different plans for me, and 4 weeks later, I was back in India just in time for a nationwide lockdown. Public spaces such as parks and malls were shut, private and public transport was halted, schools and offices either moved online or closed. April to May is also the peak of summer in India, when most schools are shut for the summer and children tend to go for camps or on holiday with their families. With schools shut, camps cancelled, children had to stay indoors. Their play was restricted to their homes, typically apartments. Some families had access to their own private gardens or terraces, allowing for easier outdoor play. While trying to take stock of what my next steps could be, I realised that I had a baseline ready and waiting to make the most of all the uncertainty. I reached out to the families who had already participated, and they all agreed to take part. By the time I conducted the interviews, all six families had experienced at least 10 weeks of strict lockdown. I wanted to understand what their experience with play had been during the lockdown. I conducted the interviews via video call, typically on weekends with the children floating across the screens, or after the children had gone to bed during the week. For parents who had participated in the first round, I asked follow-up questions about their routine, significant changes, what they were enjoying or what was challenging about the lockdown. I also asked questions based on their responses to the first round. If I felt the lockdown might have affected their experience in some way, for example, fathers who were travelling for work, or going to the playground with friends, or going to nursery. Where participants had not taken part previously, I asked them questions to cover ground from the first round, as well as questions to track any effects of the lockdown. These transcripts are currently being analysed, but the whole process has been extremely interesting. Several parents reported that playgrounds being shut did not stop them from outdoor exploration and physical play, with several parents saying that they actually explored their immediate surroundings much more than ever before. Across the board, screen time had increased for all the children, though the content of it varied. With parents and children both having to spend more time at home than before, families were really enjoying the time that they'd got together. A universal response was about much greater involvement of fathers in the children's play and everyday routines. As fathers were at home during the lockdown, they were able to spend more time with their families than they would have if they had to go into work. Their involvement ranged from the child's self-care activities, to play, to office hours, to potential long-term changes owing to their lockdown experience. It was also interesting to see that the lockdown had influenced the children's pretend play in some cases. For some children, they began enacting what they watched as a result of increased screen time during the lockdown. For others, the link was much more direct, with them incorporating lockdown rituals or vocabulary in their play, like in the quotes here. One child had normalized wearing masks, despite never having stepped out wearing one herself, while another replicated their family's sanitizing rituals with his toys. A word that was used by parents, typically to describe the father's play, was must be. Here's a collection of words used by parents in my interviews to discuss must be. Literally, in Hindi, this means fun. However, in the context of play, it encompasses a vast yet distinct set of behaviors, rough and tumble, teasing, pretend play, activities that involve an element of mischief, excitement, and fun. While the word was used to refer to different activities, it implied similar emotions and experiences. This has hardly been discussed in any literature, but I think it's an important aspect of play that prevails across India. I'm currently preparing the data for thematic analysis, and I still have a number of dots to connect. But one thing I have come to believe in, even more than before, were that possible, is the power of play. That play not only survives in all conditions, but that it helps, especially children, to make it through all kinds of challenges. The parents I spoke to all said that their child continued to play through the lockdown. Despite the restrictions, children and their play adapted to thrive through it all. Thank you for your time and attention, and for joining us for this unique exchange. Please feel free to direct questions towards me or reach out later with questions or comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Krishna. If I could invite Amy Jo to also join us, then we can go straight into questions. I've got some questions, but I'm going to be good and pass on some of the questions that have come from the floor. We've had a few. Please do, if you have some other questions for either of our speakers or for both, please do send them in pretty quickly because we've got 10 minutes now for discussion, but I've already got some questions to work through. So if you want one answered, it needs to come in the next couple of minutes, really. I'm going to start off with a question from Rebecca Fisk. Thank you, Rebecca. And this is the first question to Amy Jo. So this is a question about the countries and places that were included in your research. So were the countries you drew from for your research similar in their location system? Rebecca noticed that there weren't any European countries, and I think was wondering about how similar or different those education systems were.
So a really interesting question. I think that the lack of any geography is more driven by probably the databases that I used, and even more so maybe the institutional websites. We definitely started aiming to try to get more a more global spread. So institutional databases via the World Bank or the Africa Regional Education Database. So we're looking to expand very greatly. So that's one piece. And I think the other piece is whether or not, and to the extent to which they were among these distributional studies that looked at distributional mechanisms for tackling inequality. And the third, did they have play? I mean, I think once you apply all of those different lenses, we wound up with fewer European studies. I did come across European studies, but they didn't have sort of one of those elements. There wasn't a tackling of inequality, or there was no viable or really obvious way in which it was utilizing play in the ways that it was described, at least in the brief piece on the intervention.
Thank you very much. So the next question I'm going to direct to both of you. So this is from Victor. The question was asked during your presentation, Amy, but actually I think it applies to both. So Victor is curious if there is any way of looking at addressing gender inequalities through play. So if we think about both how you might study it, but also how you might influence gender inequalities, I mean, it's obviously an issue that's applicable to India as much as it is to anywhere else. So I'd be interested in both and what both you might have to say about that, about the potential to understand and change gender inequalities and gender norms through play. Nice, easy one.
So we definitely looked at all kinds of inequalities that might have been addressed. And the reality was that in all of the settings, it was about socioeconomic. Sometimes that was overlaid with urban-rural. And in one case, it was both socioeconomic and Hispanic, non-Hispanic. They closed that gap as well. But actually, we didn't find in these settings, and I assume the authors looked for them and didn't find them, and a few of them, actually, I did ask them straight up. And it wasn't there. And I think this is something that sort of in the past we have experience with at these early ages with measures that are looking at these sort of school readiness outcomes. We don't see a lot of gender differentials. That isn't to say that in the classroom and dynamics, sort of the more relational side, you aren't creating and reproducing gender dynamics. It's just the way that this study looked at inequalities, it wasn't a big theme across the studies.
Krishna, do you want to add anything from your study or your work?
I think, like you said, obviously gender inequality does exist in India to a great extent. But within the, I found within the families that I included in my study, there was quite a mix where there were some families that had quite typical gender roles and expectations with the children. And this tended to come out with the play that they had with their children, where you had your typical example, say, of cooking or dress up versus building and running around. That did come up with a few families. However, there were also other instances where it was just, well, she likes running around or he just really likes colouring, and that's all that really matters. So I think it's quite interesting to see that even within a similar background of families, if you will, there was quite a broad range of their understanding of it. So I think it's something that does need to be tackled, but I think a good way of doing it would be to start off with parents' understanding of how they think play might manifest differently for boys and girls, if at all.
Thank you very much. The questions are coming in thick and fast now. So the next one is for Amy. This is from Yasmin, came in while you were doing your talk, actually. So this one is, what's the interface between play, per se, and stimulation in early childhood education? So a bit of a conceptual question, but it's an interesting one about where you differentiate between play aspects of interventions and the development.
Yeah, a really interesting question. And I think conceptually, at least in the sort of dialogues that I'm most commonly involved in, one talks about play in an early childhood or older childhood phase, and stimulation is more in the younger age span, the 0 to 3, where maybe the extent of the child's activity and choice might be more limited. That's sort of where I see it. I think for these studies, because we're looking primarily at 3 to 6 and at sort of classroom-based preschools, it's primarily a space in where we're looking at sort of learning through play. And I think importantly for probably yours and several of the questions that I was able to glance through while Krishna was presenting, is that this is really a study limited by the fact that we're asking authors to think back to their time in the classroom. This is not an observational study. I wish we had observational data on these things. And I'm hoping that what it does is set the stage for future observational studies. But this is really a recollection of things that they saw and experienced maybe a year or even longer after.
The next question is for Krishna, and this comes from Audrey Kittredge, who used to work with Pedal and is now based in North America. So Audrey, as well as saying thank you very much for the lovely presentation, and that applies to both presentations. Audrey's curious what kind of findings, Krishna, you were anticipating in parent-child play in lower SES families in India. And I think part of the reason for that question she's suggesting is that maybe higher SES families that you started with, perhaps more influenced by Western culture. I don't know, you tell us what you think about that as someone from the country.
Thank you, and thanks Audrey for that. I think in general, based on interventions and other studies, other research that I've looked at so far, play as a means for aiding children's development or helping children in some way, the impact has been found to be greatest for children from lower resource communities, which is probably the first motivation for me to move towards a lower socioeconomic sort of demographic in India. Apart from that, it's very true that it's likely that mid to higher socioeconomic sort of families in that group in India are quite influenced by Western play or Western culture or media in some way. And I think I really wanted to go to the basics to either what play is like inherently in Indian culture, or also play in places where you can't get your fancy flashing screaming toys and you're having to make do with fewer resources, maybe kitchen vessels that you have or a box, or playing outdoors. Outdoor play features hugely in India because the weather's great most of the time. So I think that's something that I was really interested in looking at, which is why I wanted to focus on lower socioeconomic families. And I think it's something that once I get this study done, I definitely like to come back and examine a bit more.
For another seminar. So I think we've got time for just, I'll squeeze one more quick question in. We're coming up to time, but this one's for you, Amy Jo. This is from Mandy Andrews, and is asking about the five specific types of play that you selected and asking why those ones were selected when there are other more complex taxonomies, and also whether there's a danger of the selection of those five kind of directing the findings. So you can say something about how that works.
Absolutely. So nice. This was already really complex for the authors. As I mentioned, sort of looking back and trying to think through, okay, remember last time I was there, did I see this? So but this is also sort of right now what the LEGO Foundation has been using to think about play and the lenses through them. And I think in our measurement work moving forward, we'll be looking at sort of more and different taxonomies. If you want to send me your ideas, super happy to receive them and build them into our further thinking, because I think there are very, very many ways to think about play. And I think, as Krishna said, several of them fall short when you're crossing vast distances and cultures, which certainly we did in this study. And as we get sort of more and more into sort of the details and getting more sophisticated, certainly in measurement of play and the holistic outcomes, as I was saying, that it influences, I think we need to sort of take on a breadth of taxonomy. So you have my email, send them.
Thank you very much, Amy Jo. I'm very sorry to have that as a question right at the end and rush, because it's obviously one that deserves a lot longer for consideration.
You have another seminar.
Yes. And there are a large number of other questions which we haven't managed to get to. But thank you to all the people attending, and thank you for those who did send in questions. You've got contact details for the speakers and also for the centre. If you want to follow up with any conversations, please do. We've got another session next week at the same time with two other excellent speakers, but I'm not going to say anything more about that because I've run out of time. But do tune in, register and tune in if you want to. It just remains for me to thank our two speakers very much. Thank you very much, Amy Jo.
Thank you for the opportunity.
For fascinating talks and for answering the questions. So thank you very much, and goodbye to everybody.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.